You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 3, Kidnapping, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 6, Learning to Fly. In much the same way that Kuro's bag could hold a small office's worth of furniture, Friday afternoons could contain the same number of minutes as the whole of the rest of the school week. In recognition of this phenomenon, Mr. Pendragon canceled Friday's spellcraft lessons and declared it independent study time for his students. This act of charity solidified the teacher as nearly everyone's favorite. Kuro was less taken with the man than most. He could respect Pendragon's skill as a performer and appreciate that he manipulated his students with guile rather than the fear of failure most teachers used. Unlike his classmates, though, he was still able to recognize that they were being conned. Also, that they were not the only victims in the plot. Teachers were no more immune to the stretching of time caused by an impending weekend than the students. Pendragon's generous gift to his class allowed him to escape his own Friday lectures, instead inflicting his students on the librarian. She, no doubt, would have preferred not to spend the back end of her week cleaning up after rowdy teens who either left books scattered about, or worse, returned them to the wrong place. Kuro's very presence in the library was a burden. A wandering hurricane interacts poorly with open books. He learned in the first week that entering the library without ample warning would lead to an unmitigated disaster. At best, people would lose their pages. At worst, books would lose theirs. He had forged an arrangement with the librarian to arrive early, grab whatever books he thought he might need, and ensconce himself at a corner table by a window, where his breeze could play outside a bit and not disrupt or destroy much. He also prepared enough paperweights to hold down any work his friends might leave, as they used his table as a base to collect books and notes. That arrangement also made him very easy to find. He hadn't imagined that being an issue. Historically, people either ignored or avoided Kuro, but the rumor that he had information about the summer air had spread, and for reasons beyond his comprehension, everyone believed it. He received regular visitors to his library desk, each seeking to coax secrets from him. People he'd never spoken more than a greeting to would act like old friends in whom Kuro could confide. Others would ply him with promises of shared wealth and prestige, imagining that he simply hadn't been offered an adequate reward for his knowledge. Some even tried leveling threats to get information, which Kuro found adorable. His classmates were unpracticed in the art of terror and deeply underestimated his experience with it. The efforts were fruitless, although students broadly believed this was because Kuro was resilient rather than ignorant. He was approached from all angles in efforts to shatter his defenses or trick him into revealing something. The possibility that he actually didn't know anything never seemed to occur to anyone. They were meant to be doing research on methods of ascending to the high school. The lack of direct supervision meant that they had been free to neglect that task for a few weeks and had instead annoyed Kuro with questions he couldn't answer or generally slacked off. Now most of the class was cramming all their work into the last library day before the report was due. Kuro flipped sullenly through yet another book of enchantments. Unlike most of his classmates, he had been working earnestly every week, and that hard work had rewarded him with a certainty of his own defeat. Every possibility required some combination of skill, talent, and money, all of which Kuro lacked. The school would provide supplies for something cheap like a broom, but operating those required at least rudimentary telekinetic ability, which Kuro had failed to develop. There were options that could be operated without magic, like a self-inflating hot air balloon, but that required 50 yards of ethereal silk, which would take his entire natural life to weave himself or earn enough money to buy. He added another impossibility to his list. A gravity-defying rickshaw seemed fun, but he didn't have any way to get the quantity of opal needed to create the enchanted wheels, nor an adequately large skink to pull it. He was briefly rescued from whatever disappointment might be found on the following pages by Marie slamming a huge tome down on the table across from him. "I have decided," she said with joyous certainty.
This is definitely the best one.
You said the same thing last week, replied Kuro. Twice. He went back to reading, expecting her to return to delving through more books in search of new and exciting possibilities as she had before. Marie's enthusiasm would not be diminished by anything so mundane as her own words.
That was true then, but this is even better. Look!
She opened her book to an earmarked page and shoved it in Kuro's face, far too close for him to actually read it.
Wings! I can have wings! I could fly like a bird! There's a spell that can let you grow parts of your familiar. I could get raven wings on my back. And there's another spell to enchant them like brooms so you can flap them. Isn't that great?
Her gusto roused Charlie from her own work, or rather from reading the novel she had hidden in a larger book on gravity enchantments.
Are you sure you don't want something safer?
She asked.
Wings are very hard to operate. Even if you're good at it, an unexpected gust of wind could slam you into the cliff.
Marie rolled her eyes and groaned.
I cannot believe you. How can you not want to fly? Is there a better reason to learn magic? Why are we here if not for this? Where is your sense of adventure?
A low grumble from Arthur, approaching with a volume on broom optimization under one arm, caught their attention. He was scowling at them and rearranging his teeth in a way that let Kuro know he was unhappy with the state of affairs, but couldn't yet put it into words. That provided an opportunity to break up the debate between the girls before it became too loud for the library.
What's wrong?
Kuro asked as Marie paused for breath. It took a few seconds for Arthur to settle on a facial structure that adequately expressed his annoyance.
Did you three switch brains?
They looked between themselves in hopes that one of the others might be able to decipher Arthur's comment. With no insight to be found, they turned back to him with looks of mutual confusion.
Marie won't sit still or stop talking, and is excited about ridiculous things. Charlie is all of a sudden afraid of danger and adventure, and Kuro has been mostly ignoring us and getting his work done. It's like you traded personalities. I don't like it. Please stop.
It wasn't in Arthur's nature to insult anyone intentionally, which was what made him so devastatingly good at it. Marie was the first to respond, which only highlighted how unusually quiet Charlie was.
I have been waiting for this from our very first day of school. I guess flying is nothing special for wizards like you, but we cannot do anything like it in the Blandlands. It's exciting for me, and you are all kind of spoiling it.
Charlie responded with an uncharacteristic apology. It wasn't that apologizing was unusual for her. She did so frequently. Every time she knocked something over, walked into someone, spoke out of turn, or her generally unflappable enthusiasm flapped hard enough to rumple someone else's mood. Those apologies, however, were filled with vigor and equally earnest and unkeepable promises never to do it again. This was just an understated, "I'm sorry." That reply drew more attention than any extended rambling apology could have. Marie's zeal for flight was jettisoned in favor of concern for her roommate.
"Are you okay?"
she asked. Charlie was slow to respond. She sat very still and avoided meeting anyone's eyes while she wrestled with some deeply held secret. In a voice barely more than a whisper, and in a tone that sounded as though she were confessing to several murders, she said,
"I'm afraid of flying."
Kuro looked to Arthur, whose scowl confirmed that all of this was very confusing and out of character.
"You are not?" Marie scoffed at Charlie's confession.
"We go flying almost every day together."
"That's different," argued Charlie. "That's just our familiars. If Henrietta or your raven falls, they would just pop, and sure, it wouldn't be fun to suck up those memories, but it wouldn't actually hurt at all. Real flying is dangerous, and one little mistake can be deadly, and I don't think you're taking this seriously enough, Marie."
Marie's response was a warm smile, which Charlie took as an insult.
"Make fun of me all you want. I'm just trying to protect you from yourself."
She wagged a finger at all of them like a lecturing parent. Marie didn't confer with the others before speaking for them.
"We are not making fun of you. We are just surprised. I didn't think you were afraid of anything."
Charlie flushed and blew out her cheeks, entirely unprepared to defend against that level of compliment.
"Well, you know, it's just,"
she stammered out, which only widened Marie's smile and thereby deepened Charlie's embarrassment.
"I had a bad experience once,"
she mumbled, fussing with her hair. All three settled in for a story, but it didn't start like one of Charlie's usual tales. She was quiet and downcast, and rather than flowing forth endlessly, she had to force each word out.
"I was only 4,
she began.
We'd just been sent a griffin to take care of that had been saddle trained. I got it in my head that meant I could just hop on her back and she'd take me for a ride.
She interrupted herself with a vigorous defense of the beast.
Not that it was her fault at all. She just did what she'd been trained to do. She's a good girl. I don't blame her for a minute.
The brief burst of energy drained away and her eyes drifted to the distance, watching her memory play out through the window behind Kuro.
But a toddler can't really ride. They can just open a gate and try to hang on. I was better at hanging on than I should have been. If I'd let go sooner, it wouldn't have been so bad. I fell off over the woods near my house, bounced through some branches, landed on rocks, broke my neck, some other stuff. It took hours for my dad to find me. Doctors said I was lucky to survive.
Her gaze shifted to her one arm that was lying limply on the table. She weakly clenched and released a fist on the hand she could still move without the aid of magic.
Still hurts. I can't even feel most of my body. I have fresh cuts and bruises I can't feel, but the pain from when I broke is still there.
Marie moved to Charlie and gave her an apologetic hug. You hide it so well, I forget sometimes. Charlie was heartened by that. She got angry if she ever thought someone was treating her differently. Most of the other students didn't even know. They just assumed Charlie was clumsy and inattentive when she slid off chairs, knocked things over, or failed to respond to a tap on the shoulder. For the most part, they were correct. But it was never clear how much of that was truly Charlie and how much was a mask. As people had returned to behaving more in ways that Arthur recognized, or at the very least with good explanations for their strangeness, he rejoined the conversation. Is that why you never ride on your familiar? I expected you to be on her as soon as teachers weren't looking. Charlie flung her arms up at the suggestion.
Of course I'm not going to ride Henrietta. She's way too excitable and so tall that even if she didn't fly, she'd probably dump me off and get me hurt. She doesn't even have a saddle, and even if she did, I wouldn't trust her not to just take off the moment I was on her back. You've seen her. She's itching to fly off with someone. It's what she was born for. Not that she was actually born because she's a familiar and all that, but you know what I mean.
She would probably have spent the rest of the day talking, but she was distracted by something Kuro was saying. He was mostly thinking out loud and hadn't expected it to interrupt her flow. Normally that was difficult without a natural disaster or a snack. What if you couldn't fall off? That quiet question to himself landed him on the back of a winged unicorn almost tall enough for him to walk under without ducking. Henrietta was huge and powerful beyond imagining. The thick cords of muscles that allowed her to both gallop and soar were concealed beneath her gleaming white coat, but sitting perched on her back, Kuro could feel them shifting beneath him like ocean waves. He had explained the bracelet to his friends only as preventing him from blinking like Luton, its intended purpose not seeming important. But with Charlie's confession, he thought maybe she would want to know that bracelets like his existed, and so explained what it was meant to do. That had been a mistake. 2 hours of relentless pressure from his friends followed, trying to convince him to try riding Henrietta, with Charlie being the most ardent voice both for and against it. She would entice him with promises of freedom and adventure. Then the moment she'd started to win him over, her anxieties would resurface and she'd remind him how dangerous and unnecessary it was. In the end, his own curiosity won out. He didn't really want to ride Henrietta, nor was he keen on flying. He preferred the predictability and control he had when running and jumping on his own. Yet he had a bracelet worth substantially more than he was, which was being used only for an accidental side effect rather than its intended purpose. He wanted to know if it really did what it was supposed to do. Moments after settling onto Henrietta's back, he knew it did. The faint rainbow flickering through the runes, which signaled the constant fight between the bracelet and the wind for Kuro's inertia, was drowned out by a clear white glow. The light spun around the bracelet several times as if screwing him into place and then locking into a steady shine. As it did, he felt himself become fixed on Henrietta. He was no longer sitting on her, he was attached to her. More than just being stuck on her, he was a part of her, an extra appendage, like a hand or foot. Much like a hand, he had no control over the rest of the body and was merely a victim to its whims. With his encouragement, Henrietta began to trot around the glade they'd chosen in the autumn quarter, gently trying to shake him loose as she crunched through the dry leaves. As Kuro failed to fall off, she became more confident, taking little leaps and bounds. Kuro was well and truly glued in place. Despite the lack of stirrups, saddle, or reins, he didn't slip an inch on her silky white coat. It wasn't clear that he could have dismounted if he had wanted to, which became something of a concern as Henrietta's enthusiasm for finally having a rider overflowed and her wings unfurled. At a full gallop, she leaped skywards but didn't even get a full beat of her wings out before Charlie shouted, "Don't you dare!" and unsummoned her. The winged unicorn burst into a cloud of luminous dandelion fluff, which streamed back into her creator's mind, filling her with the memories of the jaunt around the glade and leaving Kuro with nothing between him and the ground except a few too many feet of air. Being well practiced at falling from great heights, he did not panic. He took in his surroundings and carefully considered his situation. The wind roared up at him at incredible speed, despite him not even having reached the zenith of his ascent. He could feel it streaming through his hair and clothes in a battle against gravity, rendered futile by the anchor. As his momentum carried his feet above his head, he looked down on his friends, who showed no concern at all for his situation. They had become accustomed to Kuro falling from great heights and waited patiently for his safe landing. Their confidence made him consider his own motivations for keeping the other effects of the silver bracelet from them. Of course, he didn't want Charlie to worry. The whole purpose of the endeavor was to prove to her that there might be a way to ride Henrietta safely. If he had told her he had developed a more traditional relationship with gravity, it would have only made her more anxious. That was true, but it wasn't the whole story. That was just the reason he hadn't told them that day. But he'd kept it private for weeks. He twisted and rolled like a dropped cat to prepare for the landing. He wasn't even that high up. Before the anchor, he wouldn't have considered this a fall. He could have jumped almost that high from a standstill. That was the real reason he hadn't told them, he realized. It was fear. He had grown afraid of heights, afraid of falling, afraid of the only thing in his life he'd ever been truly confident about. He was afraid of them thinking less of him, worrying over him, and more than anything, he was afraid that if he said it out loud, it would become true. So long as it was a secret, he could pretend that it wasn't real, that it might be gone when he woke up, or that the wind would finally find an angle of attack to break through the bracelet's defenses, allowing them to run together once again. The impact rid him of that fantasy. He landed as well as one could without aid, feet first, with moderate tension in the legs to slow the body without shattering anything important, then hands and arms to do the same, all a little off-center, so that he rolled slightly to one side, rather than having his face meet the soil at speed. It was, by any reasonable standard, an expertly executed landing, which meant that it only hurt very, very badly. He lay on the ground, unmoving, fielding complaints from his various joints and organs, until noises of concern from his friends forced him to provide some sign of life. An upturned thumb on a raised arm was insufficient assurance, and he felt their footfalls thumping towards him at a run. He pushed himself upright to meet them. Far worse than the rolled ankle or wrenched shoulder was having to explain what happened. It was exactly as horrible as he'd expected, as he told them the truth of it, that he couldn't run, jump, climb, or fall any better than a bland lander in a light breeze, their eyes filled with pity. He almost wished he'd gotten properly injured in the fall, so the panic over excessive blood loss would distract them. He was saved from the outpouring of sympathies by something with which he was much more experienced. Rage. Once he'd proved to Charlie's satisfaction that he was sufficiently uninjured to walk without support, she tore into him with a fury that shriveled the fallen leaves around her. "You could have died!" she yelled while slamming a finger into his chest to punctuate every word. "The only reason I let you go anywhere near Henrietta was because I knew you could land safely if anything went wrong, and you let me believe that, knowing full well that you would fall like a rock!" Kuro tried to defend himself and his mount. "But the bracelet worked great. Henrietta could tell I wasn't going to fall off. She didn't even try flying until she was sure," was all he managed to say before getting cut off. "Henrietta is flighty and irresponsible and can't be trusted with anyone's safety," Charlie shouted as though accusing Kuro of mounting a wild beast. "No, she's not." Kuro felt strange having to defend someone's familiar from herself. "She'd never let me get hurt. She's basically you with wings." Kuro could tell that he'd said something wrong because it made Charlie so angry she ran out of words. She roared in response and stormed out of the clearing, leaving the air around her rippling with the heat of her anger.
"I really messed that up, didn't I?"
Kuro said, once her stomping had faded into the distance. Marie cocked a mocking eyebrow.
"Do you really think that she is mad at you?"
Kuro looked between Marie and the trail of singed leaves and warped saplings left in the wake of Charlie's fury.
"Yes," he ventured.
"She is angry at herself for dropping you," explained Marie. "And maybe a little more angry because you did not blame her for unsummoning Henrietta from under you."
"Should I have yelled at her? Would that have made it better?"
Marie shrugged.
"Maybe. It's hard to say. So long as you're not really hurt, she'll be okay soon."
"So I shouldn't limp around her then," Kuro concluded.
"How bad is your ankle?" Marie asked with renewed concern.
Kuro gave a noncommittal shrug and made a note to avoid walking too much in either of their company for a few days. In an attempt to move attention away from his accident, he said,
"I guess she won't want an anchor of her own then."
Marie shook her head.
"Oh, she definitely wants one. She is just afraid to want it."
They headed back to the lodge at a compassionate pace for their injured member. Once enough silence had accumulated, Arthur spoke up as if continuing a conversation from the library.
"I've decided to weave a flying carpet," he said in a matter-of-fact sort of manner. "A large one. That way I can carry any of you who can't get up to the high school yourselves."
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.